Hey everybody, my name is Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. Is Blair bothering anybody? Okay. Yeah, I hate it when it rains because I got turtle wax on it, so it beads up and rolls off. Well, what I like to do is I kind of like to. Did you really enjoy Daryl last week? The guy has a lot of very practical spirituality, and Daryl is a fellow that helped me out when I was new in the program. He was already in the program. He's one of the guys that helped me out get this program and encouraged me to hang with it. And I knew he would have a good message for you last week. But what I like to do sometimes is I don't do just one step in a meeting. I kind of go from one step to another. My mind has a tendency to wander. You know, some people's train of thought, they lose it. Mine gets derailed. Okay, so I kind of go from one step to another. But really, when we work the steps, part of the reason I do that is we don't do one step and stop. The way we ought to be doing the steps, and it's that way in, and it's that way, is that better?
Yeah.
Do I need to repeat myself? You got to forgive me. Sometimes I repeat myself. You got to forgive me. Sometimes I repeat myself. But the way we do the steps is one flows into the other. So I want to go back a little bit to step one, just briefly. Because to me, that is the basis. If we don't get step one, nothing else makes sense when you get right down to it, okay? Everything else is built on that. Now, there has to be more than that, because I don't doubt that for hundreds of thousands of years before 1935, a lot of alcoholics and winos and winettes were stuck in step one, you know? But they didn't have anything further to go. They could admit they're powerless over alcohol, turn their lives over to alcohol, and die. There has to be something beyond that. But step one is talking about we admit we're powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. And I like to use the word hopeless. I think I started to tell you about a young fellow that I had when I was doing treatment at a place. And I want to illustrate the point on hopeless. He had been through 7 treatments. And he said, Jerry, why can't I get this thing? And I started to talk to him a little bit and find out a little bit about him. And it became obvious that he was never really going to meetings consistently for a long time. He never really got a sponsor. He never really worked the steps. And I tried to think, well, why is this guy, he's going through all these treatments, why won't he do these things? And I began to find out that he really hadn't really worked step one. So I made an agreement with him. I said, I'll tell you what, Hopeless. I didn't call him Hopeless. I won't say his real name. By the way, his nickname today is Hopeless, and he no longer lives in Jacksonville, but he's clean and sober. He has a very good job. In fact, he got a promotion in the job that he was in. And he goes by the nickname of Hopeless in meetings. So if you ever, and I don't think he's in Mississippi either. Gee, I'm so glad you came all the way from Mississippi just to hear me. You know, humility is a trait I'm proudest of, you know, one of those things. But I made an agreement with him and I said, I'll tell you what, I'll tell you the truth if you promise not to leave. It's like, whoa, okay. I said, but we got to put it in writing. You got to promise me that if I tell you the truth, you will not leave treatment. And so we made a contract. If Jerry tells me the truth, I won't leave the treatment. I said, and you'll have to do a couple other things for me too. He says, okay. So he's all ready, you know. And I said, are you ready? You want to know the truth? He says, yeah. I said, the truth is, you're hopeless. Hopeless? I'm not hopeless. I mean, the hair on the back of his neck stood up. I thought he was going to... But not only was an alcoholic, he was a crack addict. And I'll tell you, alcoholics, you can tie them to a tree and they'll stay there for 3 days. You tie a crack addict to a tree, he's going to rip it up by the roots and beat you over the head with it. It kind of scared me. So he says, no, really? I says, you're hopeless. He says, I'm not hopeless. I said, who did you have for your counselor before me? And the person he had was my boss, okay, my clinical supervisor. I said, that's my boss. I said, she's a lot better than I am. I said, what am I supposed to do for you that she couldn't do for you? I said, who was your counselor before that? And he told me, and it was somebody else I knew who was famous in the state of Florida for being an excellent counselor. You had so-and-so? Oh, my God. What am I supposed to do for you? They can't do for you. So we started running through this thing. And I said, now, I'll tell you the truth. I says, I'm going to give you the bad news, but if you do what I tell you, I'll give you the good news later. He said, there's good news? Have to tell me I'm hopeless? I said, yeah. First of all, you got to figure out that you're hopeless. And the assignment that I gave him was 3 things to write down. What his life is going to be like continuing to drink and use drugs. What's it going to be like? Where's he going to live? How's he going to live? How long is his life going to last, continuing to do what he's doing? And how does he think he's going to die, doing what he's doing? And who's going to give a damn, doing what he's doing? And he did that assignment. And when he read it, I mean, the whole group, I mean, we just, because it was real. It was real. And I said, now the good news is, I'm hopeless too. And I am. And if any of you heard a little bit of my story, you know I'm hopeless. You know, I kind of tell a little bit of that so that you know that, you know, God, this guy can get sober. Anybody can. But that way you know I'm hopeless. He had gone in the meantime and complained to my boss. Actually, didn't complain. He went to her and says, "Am I hopeless? You know, grabbing her. Am I hopeless? She says, "No, you're not hopeless." He says, "Well, Jerry said I'm hopeless." And she kind of looked at him and she says, "Well, if Jerry said you're hopeless, you must be hopeless." You know. And then she came to me later and she says, "What did you tell so-and-so that he's hopeless for?" I said, "Because if he doesn't get step one, he will never get clean and sober. He'll never get sober. He'll never have any sobriety at all if he doesn't get step one, and he's never gotten step one." Okay? Now, another story that I relate that to is me. My sponsor asked me, when I first night I saw him getting out of jail after decorating the motel room with a flare gun. You know, most people don't do that kind of stuff. Decorating the motel room with a flare gun, getting rescued and resisting rescue from a burning motel room. They put me in this room with no doorknobs on the inside for a while, okay? And they let me stay there for a while, and they let me think after I shook down. And then when I got out, and I finally made the arrangement to pay for the damage and everything else, when I got out, the sad thing was, I knew I was going to do it again. I knew I was going to do it again. Maybe not with a flare gun, but I was going to do something crazy again. I was going to pick up the first drink or the first drink of the next series, and it was going to happen all over again. I knew I didn't want to do it again, and I knew I didn't want the consequences that came with it. But I knew from my own past history that it didn't make any difference. If they left me alone for a long enough period of time, sooner or later, I was going to pick up the first drink of the next series, and something else was going to happen. And you know, in that burning motel room, I had a chance to think. They found me huddled in the fetal position next to the gas heater of the place when they broke in to put out the fire and drag me out. And what struck me was, you know, I knew I didn't want to live that way, but I never thought about, do I want to die that way? And it really hit me, do I want to die that way? Because my kids wouldn't have known where I was. What happened to Dad? I don't know. Last time he saw him, he was riding off into the sunset with his bottle 8 months ago. Nobody's seen him since. Because I would have burned up with my ID, and I would have been another John Doe on another slab in a morgue, all right, and buried in a pauper's grave. And I knew it was going to happen again, and if they left me alone long enough, sooner or later, it was going to happen again. The only other thing I knew for sure was that there were people like you and me, all right, people just like me, that somehow didn't have to drink a day at a time, and they smiled, and it wasn't fake. Because they're a reason that we're happy, and they were free and loose in their own skin walking around. And how they do that? You know, I couldn't figure out how they do that.
It must be a secret. They put it on the wall here, and, you know, it's a big secret.
You ever do that? You go to a meeting, you know, especially when you're new, you know, they're going to tell me. I used to do that to my sponsor, you know. I'd get there, and see, my first higher power was my sponsor and the group of alcoholics. I couldn't relate to God because, first of all, I felt that I was too bad to pray. Can you imagine that? Thinking you're too bad to pray, you've done too many bad things that even God can't forgive you? Is that the height of egotism or what? Right? I mean, I used to drive back and forth to Fernandina Beach along the beach and see the tide and the ocean and the sun come up, and everything was on time and it was always perfect. And I would create something, I'd do something so bad that the God that created all that couldn't forgive it. I talk about the height of egotism. But at that time, I felt too bad to pray, if you can imagine it. So initially, my higher power got to be the group, and it got to be my sponsor. And my sponsor would tell me things to do, and I had just given up. I had thrown out everything I thought I knew about living, because it didn't work, and decided to try somebody else's way. And he would say things like, "Jerry, I want you to get to the meeting a half an hour early." And I thought, oh great, he's gonna give me the secret. You know, I thought you had to go through this
kind of initiation period, and then after you've been there for a while, they take you in the back room and they tell you the secret. So I get there half an hour early and I'm ready for Ed to talk to me, you know, and he'd say, okay, Jerry, what I want you to do is I want you to put out the chairs and the ashtrays and, you know, kind of arrange. I said, how's that going to keep me sober? He said, don't worry about it. It will, you know. So I put out the chairs and the ashtrays, you know, and then he'd say, Jerry, after me, I want you to stick around for a few minutes. Oh, great, now he's going to give me the secret, right? So I'd stick around, yeah, I'm here. And he says, okay, I want you to clean up the ashtrays, put the chairs back up, and how is this going to keep me sober, right? And he says, don't worry about it, it will. And one time he says, Jerry, you ever done any 12-step work? And this is after the meeting, after he asked me to stick around. No, I'm ready, you know. He says, reach behind him, hand me a dust mop. He says, take 12 steps this way. Turn around, take 12 steps back that way. How in the hell is being a janitor going to keep me sober? Don't worry about it. It'll work. Okay? The only thing I did right for a change was listen to somebody else, even though I resisted, was listen to somebody else and do what they said. I didn't think the way I was supposed to think, but I became willing to do what they suggested, in spite of the way I was thinking. Okay? And that's important, because we'll talk about it a little bit later on. But what he was doing, and I can see it now, he was getting me there early. And guess who else, while I was there early, was putting out chairs and ashtrays and making coffee? And he was having me hang around late. And guess who else was hanging around late, cleaning up the place? Grateful alcoholics. Grateful alcoholics. Somebody who wanted to give a little something back somehow and felt responsible for that part in that group. Okay? And I was getting to know other people that were sober. And they were getting to know me. And that group became my higher power in the beginning. Because if I hung with them and they get to know me and I get to know them, I knew, it's okay, I'm okay tonight. I'm okay for right now. I'm okay while I'm with them. Okay? What happens is, step one is the basis for everything else. People talk about slips. I used to say, I never slipped. I always drank on purpose. You know, I never knew what was going to happen. Okay? But a slip to me is the first sign of a relapse is getting cured. Think about it. First sign of a relapse is the feeling of getting cured. Because as soon as I start to feel cured, well, maybe I don't have to go to those meetings anymore. And I'm doing pretty well. You know, gee, I don't really need to call my sponsor. I'm doing pretty well. And gee, you know, I really don't need to do an inventory because I'm not doing anything wrong. And I start backing off because I'm cured. And when I back off what I need to do, the relapse actually begins to happen long before picking up the drink. In fact, picking up the drink is the end of the relapse, is the beginning of the binge. Okay? The relapse starts when I start to feel cured and I don't have to do the things on an ongoing basis that I had to do in the beginning. All right? Does that make sense? Okay. If we get step one, and he talked about this in the 12 and 12, and this was important enough that I want to read this to you. A lot of the stuff that I'm talking about is my own interpretation. Okay? But I think it's consistent with what's in the big book. The end of step one, in the 12 and 12. In AA's pioneering time, none but the most desperate cases could swallow and digest this unpalatable truth, being powerless over alcohol. Even these last gaspers often had difficulty in realizing how hopeless they actually were. Okay, he uses the word hopeless. I didn't come up with that. But a few did, and when these laid hold of AA principles with all the fervor with which the drowning seas life preservers, they almost invariably got well. That is why the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, published when our membership was small, dealt with low bottom cases only. Many less desperate alcoholics tried AA but did not succeed because they could not make the admission of hopelessness. Okay? They couldn't make the admission of hopelessness. When I look back on my drinking career and my early attempts at getting sober, I could not really make the admission of hopelessness. And the basis for everything else that I needed to do was not there. The foundation was just not there, okay, until I could make that admission. It is tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years, this changed. And he talks about alcoholics who still had their cars and houses and wives and so forth. Wife, one wife per alcoholic at a time, presumably. Although some people, no. Since step one requires admission that our lives have become unmanageable, how could people such as these take this step? It was obviously necessary to raise the bottom the rest of us had hit to the point where it could hit them. By going back in our own drinking histories, we could show that years before we realized it, we were out of control. That our drinking, even then, was no mere habit. That it was indeed the beginning of a fatal progression. To the doubters, we could say, perhaps you're not an alcoholic after all. Yeah, okay? And then he talks about going out and trying a few things. Following every spree, the alcoholic would say to himself, maybe those AAs are right after all. After a few such experiences, often years before the onset of extreme difficulties, he would return to us convinced. He had hit bottom as truly as any of us. John Barleycorn himself had become our best advocate. Why all this insistence that every AA must hit bottom first? The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they have hit bottom. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. And he starts talking about who wants to, and I'll tell you, I thought about this. Do I know people in the real world that make a list of their inventory, you know, and then go tell somebody about it? Well, not many, if any. Do I know people in the real world that make a list of people they'd harm and then go make amends to them? I can't think of anybody I know that does that, except people in this program, okay? If that's so unusual and that's so difficult for average people to do, then the basis for everything that we do hereafter has got to be step one. Now, here's how my sponsor did it. He asked me one time, because I told him I had been around the program for several years, all around the outskirts, but I never got sober. He says, well, what step did you get to? Well, I got to step three. Okay. He says, Jerry, what does step three say? Well, we made a decision, blah, blah, blah. He says, if you made that decision, why didn't you do step four? Ooh. Well, you do that with your sponsor once in a while, and you start sinking down and, you know, getting sweaty palms and all that, especially when they're a big book Nazi and they're ex-Marines and they weigh 240 pounds. I tell you what, I wasn't worried about the drinking killed me. I figured if I had a relapse, he would. Okay? All right. But anyway, he says, and if you didn't do step three, if you didn't really make a decision to turn your will and your life over to care of God, and if you didn't get into action, you certainly didn't make a decision. You just thought about it. Okay? Why didn't you make that decision? Maybe you thought you could do it some other way. Okay? Maybe you didn't believe that this higher power would restore you to sanity. Maybe you thought there was another way, so I took back step two. And whose way did I think was going to work? The great moi. Okay? So I took back step one. There you go. All right? And I do this. I'm a little bit hard on this because I'll tell you what. I see a lot of people around AA and in, quote, AA, but not doing the AA program. And don't get me wrong, I think the fellowship is wonderful. I think it's wonderful. It's how we get the program. But the program is those 12 steps. That is the program of recovery. And we get it from each other. I don't know why. I've been thinking about why does AA work and other things didn't work, you know, and I thought a lot about that because, you know, there were psychiatrists and there were ministers long before AA came around and it didn't work, all right? And I started thinking about, in my own case, I don't know how you are, but I never really did cotton up much to a minister who was telling me how to get to heaven and avoid hell. He ain't been to your place yet, okay? But I mean, I start talking to these drunks and they've been where I've been and they are where I want to go and I could relate to them, okay? And besides the minister, I could always in my mind say he's judgmental, and I could always discard what he was saying because I didn't believe it. How would he know? He hadn't experienced it. Okay? Did he try it? Did it work for him? Or is he just telling me? Okay? Well, if he hadn't tried it, it hadn't worked for him. He's just telling me. Same thing with a psychiatrist. How in the world would he know? But I could believe what I saw. For some reason, my belief had to be something tangible in the beginning. And I saw you people, and I saw people that had lived life like the way I had lived life, if you want to call it living. And I could tell you weren't faking, because nobody knows. You know what? When an alcoholic talks about an alcoholic, we can talk about things. You know, I can talk about blackouts. I love the movie. I love that TV series, Quantum Leap. You know? I mean, here's this guy, he comes through, and he's flying an airplane, you know? I can relate to that. I can admit, you know... I remember coming to in a bar, sitting there talking to a stewardess and her calling me captain. Oh, what am I supposed to do now? You know?
and he'd jump into another body, and he'd be a doctor next time. And I can remember coming to, and you know, sitting next to a nurse someplace on a plane, and her calling me doctor. Oh, well, what did I do now? You know, that kind of thing. I could really relate to that. You know, you tell that to an earth person, you know what it's going to do? God, is he nuts? You know, this is, but you guys, you kind of sit there, yeah, I know what he's talking about. Yeah, I know what that is. Yeah, it's just like that movie Quantum Leap, you know, the guy leaps into it and he's, now who am I and what am I supposed to be doing? You know, and you got to try and figure out how you're supposed to act. That's why alcoholics lie, you know? I mean, think about it, that's why we lie. When your wife says, where were you last night? What do you tell her, the truth?
I don't know. Let me check my matchbook covers and see.
I mean, you can't say, I don't know. So you make something up, right? Oh, you wouldn't believe what happened. Let me think real quick. You know, and you make up the car broke down, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, and having fun, you know, what we think is fun and we never remember it? You know, most people have fun. Earth people have fun. They go play tiddlywinks and bingo, bowling, okay? Alcoholics have fun. You know what I mean? We have fun. Yeah, we shoot up motel rooms with flare guns, mow down our neighbors' mailboxes, and get in fights with police officers. We have fun. Okay. And every one of my drinking buddies would come over and say, come on, Jerry, let's go have some fun. You know, it's just like, you know, he's got me in a trance and I'll follow him anywhere, you know, and then to wake up in the morning and your wife say, you want to hear what you did last night? You want to watch it on the morning news. You know what I mean? Just kind of embarrassing things like that. But the insanity is, yeah, we did crazy things when we were drinking, right? We did crazy things when we were drinking. But that's not the insanity. The insanity is picking up the first drink of the next series when we're stark raving sober, or dry anyway, knowing we're going to do something crazy. And I can't tell you how many times that's happened. Okay? So where's the problem? The problem is in my mind. Okay? Most dangerous bar none, 6 inches in the world, is right between this ear and this ear. No, Dave, that's the second most dangerous 6 inches in the world. Got 5 kids to prove it. Okay, most dangerous 6 inches in the world is between this ear and this ear. Okay? Because this is where the problem lies then. If stark raving dry, or sober if you want to call it that, I pick up the first drink of the next series knowing what's going to happen. Okay? So there's got to be something bigger than us. All right? Today, I'll say this, in the beginning, because of the way I was, and I didn't feel good enough to pray, I used the group as my higher power. I used my sponsor as my higher power. Today I happen to believe, I use God as my higher power, but I happen to believe that He works through people. Okay? I think He works through you all, and I think He works through my sponsor and other people like that. But I had to get to that stage. The nice thing about step 2 and step 3 is step 2, you don't have to swallow the whole thing and digest it. I always thought, and I had a problem with step 3 too, because I always thought, I got to get good overnight. I mean, I got to turn my will and my life over to God overnight. How do I do this? And I went to my sponsor and asked him, I said, how do you turn your will and your life over to? He says, Jerry, read step 3. Read it out loud. And he pulled out the big book. He said, read it out loud. I said, make a decision. He said, stop. I said, yeah, but Ed, how do you turn your will and your life? He said, Jerry, read step 3. I said, make a decision. He said, stop. Yeah, but Ed, read step 3. I mean, about the fourth time, I'm starting to get the idea. Wait a minute, I'm missing something here. And finally, it dawned on me. Actually, it didn't dawn on me. He had to explain it. Okay? I haven't had many original thoughts. I had a bad accident today on the way over here. I was struck by an original thought and didn't know what to do for half an hour. This is just terrible. I haven't had many original thoughts, so just about everything I'm telling you, I've learned from somebody else or in the big book or whatever. He said the action part of step 3 is making the decision. Is making the decision. And when you think about it, did you ever make a decision in another area of your life? You know, I made a decision to go back to college at the ripe old age of 44. I think every alcoholic ought to do it just to see if they got brain damage. Okay? But I made a decision to go back to college at the ripe old age of 44. I thought I made that decision at 40. But all I did was talk to my wife about it. And all I did was talk to my sponsor about it. I didn't go send away from my transcripts, apply to the college, take the GRE,
put the money down for the class, buy the books, show up, and do the work. Okay? So from the age 40 to age 44, what was I doing? I was thinking about maybe someday perhaps making a decision, maybe. Okay? You know what I mean? Because how do I know now that I made a decision? When I look back on it, I know I made a decision at 44 because I got into action. Okay? Because I put the decision into action. Before then, it was just thinking about it. It was just talking about it. It was daydreaming. Maybe someday, wouldn't it be nice if maybe? Okay? And that just didn't work. Putting the decision into action is how we carry out step three. We make step three when we make the decision. We carry it out when we do the rest of the steps. Okay? If somebody doesn't have a sponsor, find somebody that's got some time in a program. I mean, a little bit of time in a program, get yourself a sponsor. All right? And because I try, you ever try and learn how to fly solo? I mean, you might get the thing off the ground, but how am I going to land this sucker now? You know? I mean, I don't want to learn how to fly solo. And the second thing I don't want to learn how to fly from is a cowboy. All right? If I want to learn how to fly, I want to learn how to fly from a pilot. You know, somebody in the right-hand seat that's got a lot of time under their belt and can bail me out when I get in trouble. So what do I want to do if I want to get sober? I want to find somebody that's done it. I don't want to learn how to fly from a cowboy. I don't want to learn how to get sober from somebody that hadn't done it. Okay? Hadn't worked the steps, hadn't got the time under the belt, and it hadn't been happy. If they have what I want, then they're reasonably happy. And I'll tell you, Ed, he saved my butt more times than I can just think of. You know, first off, me and my wife were separated. I mean, alcoholics were funny animals. I love the way alcoholics think. You know, our thinking processes, alcoholic jokes tell you how we think. The guy comes home and his wife says, "How come you're coming home half drunk?" He says, "Oh, I ran out of money." You know, I mean, it makes sense to me. You know, I told that one to my wife and she says, "Huh?" You know, I mean, she doesn't get, you know, alcoholics think alike and we think kind of crazy. You know that? I mean, you hear about the drunk is wandering through nice residential area of backyards. He kind of got lost and he ended up in this nice residential section. Here was this guy on this deck, right? This nice deck around behind this nice house, and he's grilling a chicken on a spigot. Just turning that chicken on that spigot, right? And the drunk watches him a little bit, you know, and scratches his head. Finally, he can't stand it any longer. He walks up to the guy and says, "Buddy, I don't know how to tell you this, but not only is your organ not grinding, but your monkey's on fire." You know? Just the way we think. I mean, we look at things differently than normal people do. But that's where the problem is centered. It's centered in our thinking. It's centered in the insanity, okay, of thinking that I can do the same thing this time and it's going to get a different result. Well, one of the other things that we have a tendency to do, and see if this isn't true, okay? I noticed this a lot. See, what is alcoholism? I got to put something inside me from the outside of me to make the inside of me okay. All right? That substance is alcohol. There was a time when I thought, well, I can't do alcohol, so what I'll do? I'll do something else. And you find alcoholics that say, I got to put something inside of me from the outside of me to make the inside of me okay. What'll I try? I'll try some drugs. I'll try maybe a prescription thing. You know, I'll try some pot. I'll do this, I'll do that. But it's not alcohol. See, the problem isn't in that outside thing. The problem's in here. And then once in a while, we get into AA and we try to get sober. And we also try to get the bimbo du jour, you know. Because what are we doing? We're saying, if I can't have something from the outside of me to the inside of me make the inside of me okay, maybe I can find someone on the outside of me make the inside of me okay. All right? That's what I call turning your will and your life over to your lower power. Okay? Me and my wife were separated. I didn't think we were ever going to get back together. Because she told me so when she told me to leave, you know. And somehow the way she said it, I thought she was serious. But anyway, she would, you know how sick Al-Anons are? You know, I was sober 2 months and she called me up and says, "Honey, let's try it again." I mean, you think we're sick, right? But we get together with squigglies sometimes. You never notice that? You know, you got normies and you got squigglies. You ever notice that? You got normie people out here and then you got squiggly people. And somehow, I mean, if a squiggly person dates a normie, I mean, if I was a squiggly, you know, I was a drunk and I would date a normal girl, you know what she'd do? I mean, she'd run the opposite direction as fast as she could get, right?
But my wife was an adult child of an alcoholic. Okay? I mean, this thing affects whole families sometimes. And she dated normal guys once in a while. And you know what she thought about normal guys? Boring. Okay? We lived at Florida Atlantic University on campus, and it was built on an airport, so it had a little driveway that went from, you know, the campus to the women's dorm, and it kind of went like this, a 90-degree turn, no place else to go. I mean, ditches and trees and all that. Then another 90-degree turn to the left, and right into the parking lot and the women's, you know, and she dated normal guys, and they would drive the speed limit, right? And they would put on a turn signal, like there's any place else to go. Make a right turn, speed limit, put on left turn signal, and park right in those two little spots, okay? And she'd say, boring. Okay? But then she met me. Well, how does an alcoholic go on a date? Well, first you got to get a little loose, okay? So you got to drink a little to go on a date because you can't date them until you're a little loose. So, you know, I'm a college student. I'm pretty smart. I know short distance between two lines and straight point. I jump the curb, go through the trees, the bushes, the ditches, jump the other curb again, keep going through the trees, the bushes, and bark, you know, just like that. You know what her reaction was? I found them at last. You know? I mean, So anyway, when she booted me out, you know I had to be pretty bad, right? When she finally booted me out. So anyway, I'm trying to get sober, right? And Ed finds me going over to this corner to talk to this sweet young new thing. And he says, Jerry, what are you doing? I said, well, I thought I could help her. he says, no, come on over here, boy. You know, and so next week I go over to this sweet young thing that's been around for a while. He said, what are you doing? I thought she could help me. No, you got it all wrong. I said, well, Ed, doesn't that make sense? You should have the kind of the female perspective on this whole thing. And he says, you want the female perspective? And he introduced me to this gal named Virginia. Yeah, about 200 years of sobriety, okay? She had so many wrinkles, she had to screw her hat on, okay? And she had a voice like rubbing sandpaper on a bass drum. Yeah, what do you want? You know, I mean, just... I said, why Virginia? And he said, first of all, she's too old and too ugly for you to want to have anything to do with her, okay? And secondly, she's too smart to have anything to do with you. And third, she knows the program. So, that, I mean, that's what... And you know what Virginia's passed on since, and she's probably sitting up there laughing and saying, yeah, you weren't any catch either, Jerry. So, anyway, that's... But that's, we just kind of gravity that kind of stuff. What do? We transfer the same kind of behavior into something else, that's all. So we got to try turning our will and our life over the care of God as we understood it. That decision part, making the decision, that was tough. I had, let me share something with you. You know, have you ever noticed in the 12 steps of AA, it never tells you how to stop drinking? It never tells you how to stop drinking. It mentions the word alcohol one time. We admit it, we are powerless over alcohol. And it never tells you how to stop drinking. Okay? You know what people try to do when they try to do it on their own willpower? You know, I'm not going to drink. What are they thinking about? Drinking. Right, yeah. Try this. Do not think about an elephant right now. All right? Don't think about an elephant, a pink elephant, all right, in a white tutu and ballet shoes and a red bow in his hair and a rose up its nose. But don't think about it, okay? What are you thinking about? You're thinking about a pink elephant and a white tutu and a ballet shoes with a red nose on it. Okay. You can't learn how not to do something. I always thought I was coming to A to learn how not to drink. You ever learn how not to do something? It never works. Try learning how not to ride a bike, all right? Try learning how not to read. You just can't learn how not to do something, right? What do you got to do? You got to learn how to do something. So what happens, AA comes along and it says, okay, we're not going to tell you how not to drink. We're going to tell you how to live, okay? And the very first part of that, when you get right down to it, is I'm powerless over alcohol. If I really admit that, then I better hope that there's something out there bigger than me. In the beginning, I didn't know what to believe. And Ed told me, he says, well, try the Titanic version of the higher power. And I said, the Titanic version of the higher power. And he told me the story of the Titanic version of the higher power. You know the story of the Titanic, right? 2,200 people on ship, 1,500 drowned or died, 700 were saved. About 300 or 400 of those were plucked out of the icy water by a ship that came nearby. But what happened was, this was supposed to be the unsinkable ship. Well, does that sound like an alcoholic? Yeah, I got 7 bladders. I'm an unsinkable ship, you know. I mean, nothing can, I mean, that. It's supposed to be the unsinkable ship because it had 5 or 6 separate compartments, and if one of them punctured, the others would keep it. And what happens? It hit an iceberg. The captain's first reaction was that he did not believe his ship was going down. But when it started going like this, he kind of got the idea. And once he knew that his ship was going down, the very first thing that he did was get to the radio man and said, send out an SOS signal. They did not know if there were any other ships out there. They didn't know that if there were any other ships out there that could receive the message, that they could get to them in time. But what did they have to lose? What did they have to lose? And it said, Jerry, send out your SOS signal. Doesn't matter if you know that there's something out there. Doesn't matter that you know that whatever's out there can answer you. Send out your SOS signal. In the beginning, he says, why don't you put your shoes way under the middle of your bed, okay? So that when you get up in the morning, you kind of get on your knees to find him, you know? And while you're on your knees, try saying, please, God, just for today. Just for today. He says, then when you go to bed at night, put your shoes way under the middle of your bed again. So you got to get on your knees. And while you're there, don't forget to say, thank you, God. Okay. Well, I got a water bed now, so it's kind of, you know, I can't really do that. But what I do, I found another way to do it. I glued the chips together in the order that I got them. White. Yep. Bronze. You think I'm kidding? Yeah. Bronze, you know. Red, yellow, green, blue, 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 blue. In the morning I get up, I turn the chips over so that the white one is on top, because I'm a newcomer today. Please, God, just for today. Okay? And the last thing I do when I go to bed is turn those chips over so the blue one is on top. And thank you, God, for today. Okay? Little tiny things, little mechanical things can sometimes help you. My sponsor also had me cut out the third step prayer, Xerox and cut out, and put it on my mirror. And when you read that thing slowly, you know, once in a while people memorize it and then they start doing it like they do the Hail Marys and the Our Fathers, you know. Read it slowly and think about the words. God, I give myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. That's a problem. So that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your love, your power, and your way of life. Okay. And you say those things slowly, and they begin to eventually sink in. How do I get relieved of the bondage of self? It begins with a 4-step. The end of the 3rd step, making that decision, is the beginning of the action. 1 step naturally leads into the other. It's interesting, at the end of step 2, it says, being convinced, and it goes right on into step 3. At the end of step 3, it says, it became evident that any life run on self-will alone, and it goes right into step 4. At the end of step 4, it says, next, and goes into step 5. There's no, I mean, it doesn't even break it apart in the big book, okay? In some ways, I think that's artificial. But when we get done with step 1, we go naturally to step 2. If I'm powerless, I better hope there's something bigger out there. If there is something bigger out there, what's the most logical thing in the world for me to do? Most logical thing in the world for me to do, if I believe there's something bigger than me that can help me, is to turn myself over to it. And if I do that and they give me some directions, even written instructions, then what's the most logical thing in the world for me to do if I'm really hopeless? Follow the instructions, okay? It all makes sense if you have the foundation in step 1. If you don't have the foundation in step 1, it doesn't make sense. And if it doesn't make sense to us, we won't do it, okay? The belief comes from a couple things. One is that I see it working in you. And 2, now, and this is no longer belief, this is knowledge. that I have seen it work in me so far, as long as I continue to do the things that I need to do. Okay, this is a wonderful program. We'll talk about step four next week. And like I say, in some ways, the willingness to follow someone else's directions. And a lot of times that came down to being very, very concrete. Very concrete. To listening to what Ed was telling me. Or to listen to you people in the meetings. And to follow your suggestions. That was a big step for me, to become willing to listen to somebody else and follow their suggestions. And of course, the suggestions that he had was, get into action, Jerry. And we'll talk about that a lot next week. What I wanted to impress on you is that step three very naturally leads into that. Okay, and I don't always just end on one step and go to the next step. This is a little bit unusual this week. Oh, let's see. Let me draw another analogy. Anybody ever try to learn? Anybody play the guitar? Anybody in here play the guitar? Okay. Right. What's a good song? Stairway to Heaven or Classical Gas or something like that, right? Is that a good song on a guitar? All right. Now, I have never played the guitar in my life, okay? But I would love to be able to play Classical Gas, okay? Play Classical Gas, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to borrow your guitar, I'm going to get up here, and I will play Classical Gas. Right? What do you think is going to happen? You all get up and leave, probably, right? What's this guy doing? He don't know nothing, right? Because I wouldn't be able to do it. I mean, I could muster all the willpower that I got, and I'd never be able to just sit down with willpower and play Classical Gas. But if you were a maestro with a guitar, what's your first name? Dave. Dave's a maestro with a guitar, all right, and he is an expert with it, and he's a teacher of it. If I went to him and said, hey, Dave, I want to learn how to play Classical Gas, what's he going to do? He's going to say, okay, Jerry, first we're going to learn how to tune it. No, no, you don't understand. I want to play Classical Gas. No, Jerry, first you're going to learn how to tune. But Dave, trust me, Jerry, just in. So I learned how to do it. He says, next we're going to learn some chords or whatever. Or we're going to learn how to read music. You know. And I'm wanting to play Classical Gas. But what I got to do? I got to give myself over to the maestro, to the master for a while, and follow his instructions. And if I follow his instructions, and he tells me every day, you know, you practice for an hour, you come to guitar lessons three or four times a week, you learn how to read music, and I follow his instructions every day for 2 or 3 years, guess what might happen at the end of that time? I might be able to play Classical Gas, okay, and get what I wanted in the long run that I could never do on willpower alone. I kind of liken that to turning my will and my life over to a higher power. I know what I want, but I can't get there from here, okay? I can't do it on my own, because where's the problem? It's right here. So if I'm relying on me, I'm in deep trouble, okay? So I've got to turn it over to somebody else. I've got to make that decision. And the next thing for me to do, even though I don't understand how it works in the beginning, it works just fine. But even though I don't understand that in the beginning, is to follow their directions and follow their instructions. And there's some very good reasons why this thing does work, and we'll get into that a little bit next week. Thank you very much.